We have noted the stark difference between C.K. Blandon, the grade school dropout, and George Thompson, the Oxford-educated, world-renowned journalist who had come to own the St. Paul newspapers. Differences between them certainly did not preclude a warm friendship developing, and Thompson continually trusting in Blandon's business management success kept giving him promotions until finally Blandon was made the general manager of the newspaper company. So that was certainly quite an advancement for him. But as we continue now, what happens next, boy, if you were going to use it in a novel or in a film story, it would certainly bring scoffs at having to need such a fairy tale situation. Let's take a look. In January of 1917, just a few months after Blandon had negotiated the purchase of the Grand Rapids paper mill on behalf of the Dispatch Printing Company, George Thompson died. That left the company in the hands of his widow, Abigail, who had actively shared in management of the corporation. Abigail Thompson, we've got to take a look at her now because it's an important role that she's going to play. But Abigail Thompson had developed a keen interest in business at an early age, and she was only 20 when she obtained a position as a department store buyer at a time when the profession was dominated by men. Later, she opened a small notion store in Michigan and earned enough money to build a much larger women's store in Joliet, Illinois. There, she met George Thompson. They were married in Minneapolis in 1885, the year he began his association with the St. Paul Dispatch. Abigail Thompson was described by one author of the 1920s, reflecting the perceptions of that day, as possessing an unerring instinct for business, not often found among men, and exceedingly rare among women. In St. Paul, she was known for her tireless energy and intelligent persistence in working with many causes, so long as the object was worthy and the end right. She and her husband had held equal amounts of stock in the Dispatch Printing Company. As a director of the corporation, she had provided active support for the decision to purchase the Itasca Paper Company. Abigail Thompson was 69 when her husband died, and she did not relish the prospect of directing the family business alone. Having discussed the matter with George before his death, Abigail turned to her husband's trusted manager, Charles Blandon. As there were no male heirs, she offered Blandon the most remarkable opportunity of his lifetime. Abigail agreed to give him half of the Dispatch stock. In return, Blandon was to pay her $5,000, to remain as general manager, and when possible, to give her $745,000 of company-produced dividends. On payment, the stock would be transferred to Blandon's name. In other words, by continuing his efforts to produce healthy company profits, Blandon would acquire partial ownership of the corporation without any personal investment beyond that minuscule $5,000. Furthermore, Abigail Thompson agreed that the balance of the stock would be given to Blandon after her death for another $5,000. And again, company produced dividends equal to the appraised value of the stock at the time of the transaction would be turned over to the estate. Well, wow, what a situation. For this small amount of money, Blandon would end up with property worth $1.5 million, and those are meaningful dollars in 1917. So, yes, this is certainly an opportunity that Blandon is going to jump at. $5,000 was a small sum for what he was going to get, but it was a very large sum of money for Blandon. He borrowed a dollar from everyone, as he said, and somehow he scraped together the necessary amount. The close association with the Thompsons, his ability and hard work as manager of their company, plus a just plain rare lucky break, provided Blandon with prospects for wealth and success. He was elected president of the Dispatch Printing Company, and he became now the co-owner and publisher of the St. Paul newspapers and co-owner of the Itasca Paper Company in Grand Rapids. And with a couple of years later, with the passing of Abigail Thompson, then the rest of the agreement went into effect and he was sole owner. As Blondin took control of the printing company and the paper mill, he gradually assumed a lifestyle quite unlike any he had known before. He and Jenny gave up their small house on St. Paul's east side and moved to spacious new quarters in one of the city's more affluent neighborhoods. Yet even when Blondin could easily have afforded to purchase a home, he preferred to rent. Charles Blondin never acquired any particular urge to accumulate personal property or goods. Perhaps his earlier wanderings had inculcated a dislike of any restraint brought on by the responsibilities of ownership. Interestingly, and not surprisingly, in subsequent years, Blondin didn't talk about this remarkable situation that had allowed him to create the base for the successful businessman image that he projected for the rest of his life. Certainly, he had won the Thompsons' gift through his hard work and successful management of the St. Paul papers, but nonetheless, it was an outside gift, not of his own doing, that had come to so change his future. He realized that he owed the Thompsons a debt of gratitude, but that was not something he related or talked to about others. Let's just consider for a moment here Blondin's reminiscences in regard to his earlier life as source material for his biography. In the many interviews with Blondin's friends, family members, employees, and associates that were carried out in preparing this book, questions in regard to what stories Blondin had passed on about his earlier life were always included, and answers provided insight in putting together his biography. What he did like to talk about does provide useful information, but always Blondin's own thoughts about his past life must be regarded critically, taking into account his tendency to sometimes exaggerate circumstances, and sometimes, with the passage of time, there's a blurring of details. A Blondin story that indicates the need to evaluate his remembrances is his recounting of his negotiations in regard to that purchase of the Grand Rapids Mill. In the January 17, 1941 edition of the Itasca County Independent, an oft-quoted article begins, "This writer likes Mr. Blondin's story of the purchase of the paper mill here." The reporter recounts some of the Kaukauna and Appleton discussions pertaining to the sale. The article states that consummation of the sale was delayed when Frank Becker's Appleton attorney, who was drawing up the agreement, heard from Blondin that he had once worked in a printing office across the street from the lawyer's office. The article continues, "The attorney put down his pen, sat there and stared. 'You mean to tell me that years ago you worked in that printing office for $3 per week, and now you're here to buy a paper mill for $600,000 to supply print paper for two newspapers that you now own?'" Well, as we get to that point, red flags can certainly go up because, of course, Blondin was not the owner when he negotiated the sale. He was doing that as the business manager. But the story goes on to say, Mr. Blondin assured the attorney that was the fact and then told him something of his story. The attorney said, "I need to sleep on a thing like that. I want to think that over." And Mr. Blondin says he wouldn't do a thing on it until the next day. Well, this is just not true at all. This is just a totally exaggerated statement from Blondin. What we do have to tell us about these negotiations is a very nice source. I'd mentioned in the past contact with Anselm Bossert's grandson, who supplied a good deal of information about his grandfather, and also some documents that had remained in the custody of the family. And one of those documents is a 5-page letter. And this letter was sent from Becker in Kaukauna to Bussard in Grand Rapids, setting forth in full detail all of the points of negotiation as they were talking about the sale of the company. And there's certainly no mention of an incredulous attorney who had to sleep on the matter. In fact, that's not something that Becker would have tolerated anyway. It was his attorney who was doing this, and that businessman would certainly not have disrupted the proceedings for that. So this is an example, pretty extreme example, of exaggeration on the part of Blandin. Well, a great many of the reminiscences which were passed on, as he had told them to others, are fine. They're interesting detail. They provide some insight, additional insight into what's happening. But I did not want to trust those to add to the context of the book or to add to the text of the book. So I decided just simply to use them. Didn't want to ignore all that stuff, sometimes fun stuff. And so just simply kept them separate from the rest of the text. So, yeah, Blandin's own reminiscences are certainly useful, are supplying material that's valuable, but care is needed in how they're used. And next time, we'll come back to the subject as Blandin is getting closer to having much more of an impact on Grand Rapids.